The Reymouth Peninsula, Cornwall's forgotten corner, remains almost unknown to many visitors. Bordered on three sides by water, the rivers Linner, Tamar and Plymouth Sound, it is an area of outstanding natural beauty with stunning scenery, magnificent walks and secluded beaches. The historic villages along the peninsula's coastline provide the perfect base from which to explore the landscape of heath-covered headlands and cliffs, of sheltered tidal creeks, sandy beaches, lush farmland and country parks. But this is also a coastline of defence. From time immemorial, hill forts and batteries have protected the approaches to Plymouth Sound from seaborne invasion. Our exploration of the peninsula begins aboard the Cremorne Foot Ferry. Recognised as one of Plymouth's hidden gems, the ferry has plied its trade between the city's Admiral Hard Quay and Cremorne Cornwall for centuries. The 10-minute journey provides a spectacular view of Plymouth Sound, the Royal William Yard and Mount Edgecombe. Mount Edgecombe House, its gardens and parkland covers 865 acres of the Reymouth Peninsula. The Edgecombes, originally yeoman farmers high up the Devon banks of the Tamar, married well, and in the reign of Henry VIII were richly rewarded for their loyalty to the throne. The Tudor house was commissioned by Sir Richard Edgecombe, son of Piers Edgecombe of Cotethley, and was built between 1547 and 1553 by the mason Roger Palmer of North Buckland in Devon. The house inspired a new era of Tudor architecture, far removed from the regional style of low, inward-looking granite courtyard houses. The spectacle of the new house from the sea was considered so impressive that even the commander of the Spanish Armada, Medina Sidonia, said,
"I am so affected at the sight of this house from the sea that I resolve it for my own possession in the partage of this kingdom."
Unfortunately for Medina Sidonia, it was from the Edgecombe estate that the Armada was first spotted, and the alert signalled across Plymouth Sound to Drake as he played his game of bowls on Plymouth Hoe. The rest is history. I met with local church warden John Evans.
Maker Church is quite dominant on the hill of Mount Edgecombe Park and was used by the Admiralty as a signalling station where we know of employment by watchmen. We know how the signals were relayed between the Admiralty's offices down in Mount Wise. So he could signal a number of ships approaching, maybe from the east, maybe from the west, by signalling on the east side with a spar or the west side of the tower with a spar and a flag and a number of black balls to indicate the number of ships. And he could fly additional pennants to indicate whether the fleet was commanded by an admiral, and to give information such as whether he believed it was hostile or not, and whether they were lying close inshore or offshore. These sort of details, really important. We do have one ghostly story connected with Maker Church, and that's relating to the Countess of Mount Edgecombe, the first Countess. Shortly after her husband had been elevated to the peerage as an earl, she sadly died. But she didn't die. She was in a coma and placed in her coffin and was committed to burial in the vault up at Maker Church underneath the slabs in the earl's aisle. One of the stewards of the house had noticed was that this good lady, dressed in her finery, was put in her coffin with all her rings and other jewels, and thought that this would probably be inappropriate, and went up the same night to remove these jewels. With what intent, we don't know, but it may have been as a robbery. He went down into the vault, unscrewed the lid of the coffin, was then startled to find that the Countess sat up. He fled. The Countess got up rather groggily, made her way through the dark churchyard, down through the wooded area to Mount Edgecombe House, rapped on the window where the Earl of Mount Edgecombe was having dinner with some friends and mourning the loss of his wife, heard the rapping on the window, saw this ghostly figure outside and believed he had seen the ghost of his wife, quickly realised that this was more than an apparition and ran round and rescued his wife and brought her home, where she did recover and lived on a good number of years beyond her own husband's death eventually.
During the Second World War, the house was destroyed by German bombers in the Blitz on Plymouth, and the house was left as a derelict shell until 1958, when the 6th Earl commissioned Adrian Gilbert Scott, grandson of English Gothic Revival architect Sir George Gilbert Scott, to rebuild the house. In 1971, the house and grounds were jointly purchased by Plymouth City Council and Cornwall County Council and turned into a country park. Today, the Grade 2 listed house and Grade 1 listed grounds are a popular tourist destination. The country park is open daily all year round and is free to the public. Its attractions include the National Camellia Collection and a range of formal gardens in English, French and Italian styles. The park features herds of wild deer, landscape woodlands, multi-use trails, a Bronze Age barrow dating from 1200 BC, a 16th century blockhouse and the 12th century Maker Church. The southwest coastal path skirts the Edgecombe estate and heading west passes Fort Picklecombe, one of Palmerston's follies. Lord Palmerston, Foreign Secretary to Queen Victoria, commissioned a series of forts and batteries to be built along the coast to defend the naval base at Devonport against the threat of attack from the French Navy. Fort Picklecombe was built between 1864 and 1871, and by the time it was completed, the threat had largely passed. Palmerston's follies were the most costly and extensive system of defences undertaken in Britain in peacetime. The coastal path reaches an area of open grassland known as Minidew and leads past old fishing cellars and boat stores down to the twin villages of Kingsund and Corsund, once well known for their fishing and smuggling past.
The area has been quite buoyant over many centuries, but as times have passed, so the laws of the land have changed, particularly about tax. And these fishermen became really expert smugglers. And so there was a lot of excise avoidance of all the things which had taxes, whether it be rum, or not, which is the classic one, or other products which had significant taxes, like tea, I expect. There were a lot of people who made a lot of money. I'm told that the houses often were connected. People could scramble in one end with booty and then go right down the other end and drop it maybe down into somebody's vault in somebody's house.
When I'm tired and I'm lonely and far from my home, many miles from Cornwall under some forest sun,
Kingsand Community Hall is home to the Rain Peninsula Melvoice Choir, who under their musical director Jonathan Delbridge maintain the strong Cornish tradition of choral singing.
The piece The Minidew Breaks was written by a local gentleman, Peter Staniford. He wrote it and then our accompanist actually arranged it for the choir, and it's a beautiful song because it's all about the areas you'll hear in the words. It's all about the area of rain and everything, and a song that's unique to us as a choir, because as far as I know we're the only choir in Cornwall that sing it.
Where the rain water stands, gates and cold and greasy.
Most of the choir members are Cornish. We do have a few come over from Devon, a few travel in from Plymouth. We've even got one gent who lives right up on Dartmoor and comes down for practices. But most of them are from this area, some from further into Cornwall. So we've got some choir members from St Austell, St Clear, those kind of areas as well. The area does influence the music. I mean, we, as a male voice choir, there's a vast amount of traditional male voice choir music out there, and a lot of it is very influenced by Cornwall. So our aim really is to keep all the best of traditional music going, but also try to incorporate modern pieces as well. So we do some popular songs, jazz pieces, musicals and that as well. We've also got a lot of songs that we sing about the sea, and obviously here we're surrounded by the sea, so they're really influenced by the air, and they seem to go down really well with our audiences.
From Kingsund and Corsund, the coastal path leaves the shelter of Plymouth Sound and climbs through the ruggedly beautiful coastal scenery past Penley Point to Rame Head. The name Rame means the high protruding cliff. The little chapel of St Michael on the summit of the headland, licensed for Mass in 1397, is on the site of a much earlier Celtic hermitage. As early as 1486, Plymouth was paying a watchman at Rame to keep a beacon to guide shipping, and today a Coast Guard station maintains the same tradition. Out to sea, 9 miles south of Rame Head, the Eddystone Lighthouse warns vessels of the extensive reef below the waves. The views from the headland of the approaches to Plymouth Sound, Wembley Bay, Great Mewstone Island, Pollawn Cove, and the stretches of sandy beaches of Whitsun Bay remain as stunning as ever. I met with Claire Wallerstein, founder of Rame Peninsula Beach Care, a community project aiming to clean up the beaches and to raise awareness of the damage being done to the marine environment by plastic pollution.
Well, it started at the beginning of this year. In fact, it was New Year's Day. I've lived by the sea nearly all my life. I read a newspaper article which was quoting a figure from the United Nations saying that they'd now decided that every square kilometre of ocean all around the world had 46,000 visible pieces of plastic in it. And I thought, well, that can't possibly be true, you know, certainly not where I live. You know, the beaches are really clean. And I almost went out to disprove this. So New Year's Day, I went with my children down for a walk on Tregantle, which is the western end of Whitsun Bay. And, of course, in the winter, which is called the wrecking season, that's when you really get a load of flotsam and jetsam washed up on the beach. And I was absolutely horrified, because what I realised was that we go down to the beach and we quite often just walk across this tide line, which can be thick with plastic of all sizes, from everything from a huge fishing crate down to tiny, tiny little particles. But we've almost become so used to seeing it there. We just walk across it and enjoy the rest of the beach, which has been swept clean by the tide. But when you actually start to look at what's there, you realise, compared to how it was when I was little, how drastic it had become.
So you organise beach clean-ups?
With a group of friends, we've basically started to organise beach clean-ups about once a month. And over the past 6 months, we've picked up around about 300 sacks full of rubbish. Nearly all of it's plastic. The unfortunate thing is that, of course, this isn't really plastic you can recycle, so we're taking it away from the chaos of the sea where it's causing damage and death to wildlife, but really it's just going away to sit in a landfill site for 1,000 years. So what we're trying to do is find ways of making some use of this plastic so that it's actually going to go on and either have some purpose or raise awareness and teach people about what's going on in the sea. So we've been looking at a variety of ways of doing this. We had a big sculpture show in the summer. 14 local artists worked producing all sorts of sculptures and pieces of art made from what we'd been picking up. And that was very, very well. It was very successful. We got a lot of great feedback. And that show is actually going on to be seen at various places around Cornwall. And we're also, one of our sculptors is making a sculpture of a seal for the seal sanctuary as well, out of marine debris. So that's great. That's going to help get the message across. But I'm also interested in looking at other things that we can do with it now. There are new technologies where you can use ground-up waste plastic as aggregate in concrete for building blocks, road paving, patio stones, all sorts of things like that. Our entire local community has been incredibly supportive. I think our best attended beach clean, we had 70 people who came down, and we run all sorts of other events as well, and the whole community's got behind us. It's been fantastic, and the children have got very involved in as well. We've been we've done some beach cleans with them, and one of the most interesting things that we did this year was we got all the children to bring in their used plastic bottles from home. And then we worked with a local boat builder called Andy Fox, who actually built a very famous boat called the Plastiki, entirely out of thousands of plastic bottles, which then sailed across the Pacific Ocean to raise awareness about the Pacific Gyre, which is full of plastic waste. And we built our own sort of mini Plastiki, which was called Respect. And it was launched in July and sailed all over Khorsan Bay, which was fantastic. But of course, also, we were trying to make a point and raise awareness about the amount of plastic that we're throwing away each day.
The Rain Peninsula podcast is a South East Cornwall Tourism Association production. It was written and narrated by Emlyn Glamour-Harris and produced by Dead Interesting Productions. The song Minadoo Breaks, sung by the Rain Peninsula Melvoice Choir, was composed by Peter Staniforth.